Hi, I'm Rochelle Jackson, and welcome to The Crime Couch. I'm an investigative journalist and true crime author, and I know who's who in the zoo on both sides of the fence. The crims, the cops, and the interesting individuals in between. So get comfy and join me each week on The Crime Couch for a rollicking, intriguing tale. It'll be one heck of a journey. This is part one of a two-part Crime Couch podcast. Anne-Marie Presland is a person with an extraordinary story. She was the partner of Robert Bob Trimboli, a man nicknamed Australia's Most Wanted during the 1980s. Bob Trimboli was accused of being a crime boss and an all-powerful head of a mafia family dealing in drugs, tax evasion and murder. But Anne-Marie denies that he was ever involved in crime. She went on the run with Bob and lived overseas in exile and in fear with the man that she loved. Anne-Marie was also a talented singer who appeared on Bandstand and the Graham Kennedy program. She worked at Sydney's Phoenician Club. I'm sitting with Anne-Marie on the crime couch in her lounge room on a rather grey and fairly average Melbourne day. Hi, Anne-Marie. Thanks very much for sitting on the crime couch with me today.
That's fine. Thank you.
Can you tell me, when did you first meet Bob?
When I was 27 in Sydney at the Phoenician Club.
And what did it mean to you to meet someone like Bob Trimboli at that stage? Like, explain a little bit about where you were like in your life.
Well, I was working at the Phoenician Club, and I was working as a cash at the cash counter, giving change for the poker machines. And Bob came in, and he was with a lady, and they went to the bar. And the boss at the time, Charlie Zammit, introduced us. And they left about 11 o'clock, and then Bob came back with Charlie, and yeah, he said, and how's the most beautiful girl in the place? And I got a shock. I was still working behind the counter. But no, it was good. And then it went on from there. And he looked after us and, yeah.
So what were your first impressions of Bob? Did you know anything about him at all?
No, because I only just met him. And he was so friendly and he was a lovely man. And he just wanted to do whatever he could to make things nice. And yeah,
where was your life at it around that time when you were 27?
I was going through pretty hard time. I had three jobs. I worked at Mansour's in the day, and I worked at the Phoenician Club at night, and we had a shop at Redfern. My girlfriend and I, Linda, we shared a shop, and she was the babysitter. She looked after Melanie was only two, and she had her own two children. So yeah, it was pretty hectic and full on. I think I was about 7.5 stone then. I was only little and thin and, yeah, always working hard.
And you were a single mum at that stage too, weren't
yeah.
you?
Yeah, I was a single mother, yeah.
So it was a bit of a tough time. And how did Bob sort of present to you?
Oh, such a nice man. He was a lovely man. And he said if anything I needed, he'd help me. And we were having trouble at the shop because Linda couldn't cope, and he ended up saying to me, you can't stay here, you have to, he said, why don't you come out to Cabramatta and I'll get your unit out there with Melanie and you can help me in the supermarket, with the supermarket and the liquor shop we're just setting up. And just like normal people, that's what we did. And then I moved out, went into Cabramatta, got a unit. And we just went on from there.
You're pretty much like a normal couple, yeah, except normal. The big difference is, of course, is that when did you find out that Bob was married? And he
Bob
was
told me straight away. I knew that straight away.
What did he actually? How did he bring up the subject? Did he just was very upfront?
Yeah, very upfront. He said, "I would have left years ago, but I told Joan that when Craig turns 15. I'm leaving anyway. I've had enough. And I can't keep going like this. But he did go home every weekend to see those kids. He was great with the kids.
So how did you deal with that, Annie, knowing that that he was someone that was married and he continued to be married pretty much right throughout your 17-year relationship, wasn't he?
Yeah, well, I got divorced because I was still married too, and I got a divorce. And after that, everything was happening so much. Like, we were in the Blue Mountains, living in the Blue Mountains. I had a house up there. And we moved from the unit and went up to the Blue Mountains and got Melanie in school. And like we lived like normal people. We just moved. It was just hard at the time. What else happened?
Well, I think at one stage I remember you telling me that he said, look, if it wouldn't have been you, it would have been with someone else.
That's what he told me, yeah. He told me that when I first met him, because when he explained to me the situation at home, that's why he was in Sydney. He didn't live in Griffith. He lived in Sydney. And he'd bought Gail, his oldest daughter, Gail, a unit in Memorial Avenue, Liverpool. And he used to stay there when he came to Sydney. So he was living in Sydney. And the rest of the family were in Griffith. So he didn't spend much time in Griffith in those days. But when we were in the Blue Mountains, we'd only been there 3 months. We did it all up. We put a new driveway in and things. And we'd settled quite well. But when we were in the Blue Mountains, he had a phone call from one of his mates in Griffith at the time. And he was a police officer, like he knew all of them down there, and he was a policeman. And he said, Bob, I'm ringing to ask you if you could help us with an investigation down here because we don't speak Italian and we need to find out some information, and we want to know if you can find out anything for us because you can talk to them, you know, because Bob was good with most of them. So that was the start of them asking Bob to help with the investigation. But then 2 days later, the same man rang and said, oh, Bob, look, don't worry about it because there's a new investigation team coming from Sydney to do the investigation and we're not needed anymore. So these men that lived in Griffith who knew the place and knew everything about it were told to get off the case and they were sending a new team from Sydney, which didn't make sense to anyone at the time. And that's why I think a lot of information got lost and overlooked.
And what did you think that meant and what did Bob think it meant?
Politically motivated. That's what we thought. We knew something wasn't right, but we couldn't put our finger on it. But then people don't realise that running at the same time as that investigation was the Nugan Bank investigation. And then the solicitor, one of Bob's solicitors rang us and said, oh, Bob, you know, he said, it'd be a good idea if you went away for about like a little while, wouldn't be long. He said, until this all gets underway, because I've got a brother who works in Canberra, he's a politician, and he's told me that they've made a deal that the Melbourne take over the Donna McKay case, and Sydney are taking over the Nugan Bank case. Now, the tie-up there is that Frank Nugan and Han was the American, Frank Nugan's brother worked at the he was boss of the co-op in Griffith. Mm-hmm. He ran the co-op. So that was where the tie-up come in with the Nugan Hand and Griffith. So there had to be something there, and people were covering it up. And maybe, and this is what we all thought all the time, that McKay might have found out about the money going missing, because a lot of Italians invested in the Nugan Bank because all the money was going through the co-op. And Frank Nugan was a pretty wealthy man. He lived in Mossman and all this, but his brother was living in Griffith running the co-op. So that's where we think the tie-up come in, but nobody talked about it. Because when they took over the investigation in Sydney, the Nugenhan Bank was in the building, the same building as Bob Askin and Ran. And Bob had spoken to Ran about the investigation and wanted to put an inquiry. He said, well, why shouldn't I have an inquiry? You put run a Royal Commission, but you won't give me a chance to have an inquiry and have my say. You want to put me through the mill. But Ran refused because they were all in that building where the Nugenhan Bank was.
Very interesting theory. Now, okay, so you moved in with Bob. And you also had a daughter, Melanie, from your previous marriage. Yeah. How did Bob get on well with Melanie? Did he get on well?
Oh, Melanie loved Bob. She just loved him like a father. She even asked him. She said, Bob, can I – oh, she didn't say Bob. She said, can I call you Dad? And he said, darling, and he said, I'd love that. But he said, I'd rather you just call me anything else you like because I'm not your real father. You have a dad. And I'm, you know, but you can call me whatever you like. So she said, oh, she called him darling all the time, was darling.
So at the time, you knew that Bob was a gambler. He loved to punt.
Yep.
And he had a lot of cops in his pocket as well. What else did you know about him? Did you know any of the activities that he was alleged to have been involved in?
Well, the other, yes, I did. I knew about the machines here in Melbourne. Mm. Bob had machines with Frank Tattoni, pinball machines. They used to put them in milk bars and things, Bob owned them with Frank, and they had a factory in Carlton, Lygon Street, Carlton. And whenever we come to Melbourne, we come and see Mum or go to the races. We'd go to Carlton and meet Frank at the restaurant and have dinner or lunch or whatever. Mm. And maybe two or three times a year, or Frank had come to Sydney. And that's how we used to, I knew that side of what was happening, that side of the business. And
now you mean Frank Tattoni.
Frank Tattoni was the one that told us to go to his sister's in Italy when we went overseas the first time in 1981. Left the country, Frank Tattoni said, go and stay with my sister in Italy. And he told us where to go and whatever. Mm. So that's what we did. Mm-hmm. And then that was all right. He used to come over every 3 months to visit.
And was he like a working colleague with
Bob? He used to bring money over for us to survive on. And because he was making it here in Melbourne with the pinballs, and there was plenty of money coming out of the machines here, and I used to see it. And the cops all knew that the machines were running because Frank rang Bob one day and said, Bob, we've got a problem with the machines. And Bob said, what's up, Frank? He said, well, he said, the cops want to confiscate 40 of our machines. He says, well, what do you think we should do? And Frank said, well, I think they want $1,000 each. We can get them out, but they want $1,000 each machine. That's $40,000. And Bob said, well, if we've got to pay it, we've got to pay it. It's going to cost a lot more to buy new machines. So that's what they did. So they paid the cops off, or Frank did, paid the cops off here in Melbourne. And that was it. But in the end, we realised down the track further that we got to know, it could have been a lie because Frank was a greedy man, a very greedy man, and he just did whatever he liked here, and he had them all under control here. He had them all. He knew all the cops. And
so the allegations about police being on the take could exactly just be that. It could have been fictitious.
Yep.
Okay, so Bob was accused of being involved with the Mr. Asia Syndicate. What do you think about that allegation?
Well, we used to go to a restaurant in at Randwick. Was called Taddy's Restaurant. And our friend Robert Fiona, who was the boss there, he ran the restaurant, him and his wife, they used to have all different people come through, and Robert would introduce us to people. that came through, and one of those blokes that came through his restaurant, he introduced us to, was from New Zealand. And I vaguely remember, I can't remember quite remember his last name, but he was apparently caught in London or somewhere and went to jail for some sort of, I don't know, drugs or something. I don't know. I'm not quite sure. But this was where all this came up, because they said Bob knew this bloke. Well, Bob would have met him at Robert's restaurant, and that's about the only place that I couldn't, because we used to take Melanie would go upstairs in the unit. They had a little unit upstairs, and Melanie would watch TV, and we'd be downstairs in the restaurant, and all the racing people would go there, the jockeys, the trainers, would all meet back at this restaurant at Taddy's.
And that, as far as you're concerned, is the only connection?
Yep, yep.
So there's been a lot written about Bob Trimboli. In your belief, was he ever involved in crime, and would you have described him as a criminal?
No, Bob wasn't a criminal. He was a nice bloke. He worked hard. He fixed poker machines. He even did it in Sydney. We had a place down in. He was always working in the liquor shop or the supermarket or down in at the Flemington markets, where he had the he used to meet his mates up with the wine. They used to sell a lot of wine, and a lot of people from Griffith used to come to Sydney to visit us. He was always, and of course, most of the time was to do with racing, always with the racing.
He loved to punt, didn't he?
Oh, yeah, every day. He would have the office downstairs, and he had all his books and all his information down there, and he knew all the jockeys and all the trainers, and, yeah, he used to love his races. He did.
Did he back many winners, Annie?
Yeah, he did. And I used to put bets on for him too. We used to stop off at the Tab on the way to Randwick, or while he was, when I lived in the Blue Mountains, I'd go down to the local TAB and put all his bets on, because he used to say, if we don't put the bets on first, I might get the coat pullers changing my mind. So we got the bets on first. And quite often he'd come home and I would have picked up $25,000 at the local TAB. That's the sort of money, because he'd put like a couple of $100. You get a couple of daily doubles and extra doubles and quinellas and, yeah, all that sort of thing. Yeah, Bob used to punt well.
So let's talk about, he was also subpoenaed for the coroner's inquest into the Douglas and Isabel Wilson murders. Now, they were drug couriers from the Mr. Asia Syndicate, yep, and they were murdered in March 1979. Hmm. Now, if he wasn't involved, why do you believe that he was subpoenaed?
Well, they had it out for Bob. They wanted to get him. I don't know who these people are, because we never did find out, but it's like anything that's political. Let's go after this one, because that'll take the heat off everyone else. And that's this thing in Melbourne. Whatever was happening in Melbourne, this is why they wanted to bring him to Melbourne. And he knew that. He knew that if he came to Melbourne, for some unknown reason, someone in Melbourne had it out for him, they put him in jail. So that's part of the, it was a sort of a plot like going on. And he knew, he wasn't silly, that something was, because he didn't know these people. He didn't know anything about it until he got the subpoena to say, come to Melbourne.
How did he respond to getting the subpoena?
Wasn't very happy, I can tell you. He was really upset because he didn't know anything about it. But he knew something was happening, something was going on, because he had that sixth sense that, you know, there's something behind everything. And, yeah, there was.
In your belief, was he involved in the Donald Mackay murder?
No. We, as I said, Bob lived with me in the Blue Mountains in Sydney when he first got the call to say Donald Mackay was missing. That was the first call he got, and he was asked if he could give them help, which he said, yeah, oh, sure, I'll help you. Because when he was younger, they all knew him in Griffith, because he used to help a lot of the Italians in the courtroom, because when they had no one to interpret, they'd get Bob to interpret for them. And he was actually, one of the judges said, what a great job you did, Bob, you know, because one of them couldn't didn't have an Italian word for wobble, so Bob had to explain to the to the judge, this is what they meant, wobbling on a bike.
That would have given him a really good rapport, you'd think, with the local police if he's helping them out.
Well, he did. He knew the police and he was just like another bloke. They used to, you know, if they had a problem, they'd ring up, Bob, can you get in touch with your Italian mates and talk to them for us? He was a good man.
This is part one of a two-part Crime Couch podcast. Thanks for joining me. I'm Rochelle Jackson, and I look forward to your company next time on the Crime Couch.